Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Eli Lilly and Company, we had the pleasure of speaking with Eric J. Sherman, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, to discuss the prognosis of patients with RET fusion-positive medullary thyroid cancer, the data supporting the regulatory approvals of selpercatinib and pralsetinib, and future research directions with RET inhibitors in the field. In our exclusive interview, Sherman discussed the incidence of RET fusions in medullary thyroid cancer and the current clinical landscape of RET inhibitors in the field.
Could you maybe discuss the incidence of RET mutations in medullary thyroid cancer and how the presence of RET mutations really impacts the prognosis for this patient population?
Medullary thyroid cancer, about 20-25% will have hereditary medullary thyroid cancer, which means 20-25% will have a RET mutation both in the medullary thyroid cancer, but also, you know, throughout every gene in their body. So you have that group, which is a little bit different than somatic medullary thyroid cancers. In the somatic medullary thyroid cancers, you definitely see a lot of different numbers, but it's probably around 40-45% will have a RET mutation. So overall, you're going to see maybe a total of around 60-65% of medullary thyroid cancers have a RET mutation altogether.
Of course, we had selpercatinib and pralsetinib both approved for the treatment of patients with RET mutant positive MTC. But prior to these approvals, what was really the treatment pattern for this patient population who harbored these RET mutations or fusions? What was available to them?
So in medullary thyroid cancer, which are only mutations, what was available was either cabozantinib or vinditinib. Vinditinib got first approval, then cabozantinib. Both of them were initially looked at in medullary thyroid cancer because they both inhibit RET, but they inhibited multiple different targets. And because of that, that probably drove a lot of their toxicity. Early studies, at least with vinditinib, it was done exclusively in tumors that had RET mutations, either or mostly hereditary. But when both drugs were looked at in a randomized phase 3 studies against placebo, they allow all patients with medullary thyroid cancer to take place independent of RET status. And based on progression-free survival advantage compared to placebo, both drugs got FDA approved.
Let's first start with selpercatinib, which was approved in May 2020. So could you maybe highlight selpercatinib's mechanism of action and what really makes it a viable treatment strategy for this patient population?
So selpercatinib was really developed as really being a very selective RET inhibitor. Most of the drugs before selpercatinib and pralsetinib were really drugs that inhibited RET, but they were really VEGF TKIs. And they happen to inhibit RET as well. These drugs were really developed to be very, very selective inhibiting RET by itself. They do have a little bit of off-target effects, but their off-target effects are very, very minor, especially compared to other agents out there like cabozantinib and vinditinib. It's really set up to really just selectively inhibit RET only.
Could you maybe highlight some of the key data that led to the FDA approval of selpercatinib?
The selpercatinib data is actually pretty minor. It's really like one study. It was a phase one study just look for safety. And I think even the initial dose level allowed any patient to take part in it, but very soon was selected to tumors that had RET alterations. They found the MTD, they had a dose expansion in five different areas. The three that were important to us was in medullary thyroid cancers that were treatment naive, medullary thyroid cancers with prior treatment, and in this other population, which basically the population was where they were able to evaluate RET fusion differentiated thyroid cancers from follicular cell. It was not a randomized study at all. The data in medullary thyroid cancer was so good. It had a response rate of 69%, which pretty much unheard of. 9% of those had actually a complete response to treatment. At 1 year, 86% of those responses were still ongoing. We saw like great progression-free survival with it. We saw high risk, very, very high response rates. And really based on that data alone, the FDA approved the drug. You know, there was, I think, the understanding that the approval was based on them completing a phase three study. And that phase three study is ongoing. And that's in patients who are treatment naive, who are randomized to receive either selpercatinib or basically a dealer's choice of either vinditinib or cabozantinib. And those who get vinditinib or cabozantinib can then be crossed over to selpercatinib at time of progression. But that study is still ongoing. And just to confirm, like, you know, what was seen from this phase 1b study.
With selpercatinib being the first novel agent, I suppose, approved, how has the approval really impacted the clinical landscape for patients with RET mutant medullary thyroid cancer? How is it sort of being incorporated into clinical practice?
People use it, I think, almost exclusively like in the first line. You know, people who are on vinditinib or cabozantinib, they weren't really often taken off unless there's like really a big toxicity issue going on. And then you would get the drug. But almost everyone who are now diagnosed with medullary thyroid cancer, first, we do sequencing on all the medullary thyroid cancers at this point in time. And if they have a RET mutation, we almost always start with this drug. You know, at least like our institution, we will offer the clinical study, but, you know, a standard practice, everyone seems to want to start with selpercatinib based on the data.
So in terms of pralsetinib, does it differ at all from selpercatinib in terms of mechanism of action?
No, they're both RET-specific inhibitors. And when you look at like the efficacy and safety, I mean, there are two different studies. But you don't see a lot of gigantic differences in terms of efficacy. Even the toxicity isn't gigantic, and there may be like some small changes, but not like much. You know, maybe a little bit more QTC interval prolongation in the selpercatinib arm, maybe a little bit of more decrease in white blood count in the pralsetinib group. But in general, like they look fairly equal, and it's hard to really tell any significant difference, I think, right now between the two.
So on that note, when you are selecting an upfront treatment for patients, is there any rationale to choosing between one or the other, or is it just sort of dealer's choice, whichever, you know, the physician is most comfortable with maybe?
I think right now it's more of dealer's choice, and it really is depending on what people are more comfortable with. You know, like our institution, we took part in the selpercatinib study. And because of that, like that's the drug that I'm most familiar with. And I'm used to doing the dose reductions if necessary and using drug without any, you know, I'm just used to use that the drug without any issues. But I think that's just, at the end of the day, it really is whichever drug the physician feels most comfortable using, that's the drug that should be chosen. If there was ever like a cost difference between the two, honestly, I would always choose the one that costs less.
We talked a bit about the safety and how the profiles don't really differ between the two. Now that both are approved, what kind of toxicities are noted with these agents that prescribing physicians should maybe be aware of?
The main one that I think everyone has to always look at a little bit more carefully is liver toxicity. Definitely early in the study, you can see that people had some isolated elevations in total bilirubin. There were people who LFTs did increase. It honestly was like everything that I saw was really more focused on like this like grade one or grade two, and nothing that really was that serious. But at the end of the day, you know, I think it even got down to maybe even close to like, you know, 10%. Had grade three. With liver toxicities, there are some people have these like almost like this hypersensitivity reaction, which is also an increase that you see in LFTs. And I think that's something you have to be a little bit careful about. There is like, even though it's very, very rare, There have been some people who developed like one or two that developed like a pneumonitis or other some type of strange type of reaction. And, you know, stopping the drug lets it go away. I will say from my experience and from what was done on the study, you could restart the people very carefully at the lowest possible dose and move your way up. And people did tolerate the lower dose at that point. But those are the things you really sort of have to, like, you know, more watch. You do have to watch blood pressure. It's not at all anything like doing like cabozantinib or lenvatinib or most of the VEGF TKIs. Blood pressure is never, ever seems to be that bad. But you do see some increases in blood pressure. And I think it is important to keep an eye on that. You see some things like, and these are very minor, with like dry mouth and dry skin. And I've seen like some people with like a little bit of periorbital edema. Those things really don't bother people that much. And they're usually pretty much on the minor side. The only thing that doesn't seem to be as well listed, but it's definitely seen, and others I say the same thing, is that when people are on the drug for a while, they sometimes do develop like this abdominal discomfort and inflammation in the like the colon or ileum, with even sometimes a little bit of ascites. And, you know, there's a few, and usually it's very, very minor, but every so often it becomes more serious. And when it does, all you have to do is stop the drug, it goes away, and you use a lower dose. But we've seen that happen with people who've been on it for about a year or so. Altogether, you have to watch for QTC prolongation. I've not found that to be like a major problem. It's usually, you know, the people who seem to have it are more the people who've already had QTC prolongation before they started anything. We've also seen some very minor increases in the creatinine, but those have also been nothing serious, and often could be taken care of either with hydration or going down a little bit of the dose if it's necessary.
Are there other treatment options that are emerging or even new directions with selpercatinib and pralsetinib, such as, you know, combination strategies or anything that could maybe further the treatment of this patient population along?
So right now, I think the big thing is looking at new generation RET inhibitors. There's like a few of them that are out there, and it's always still a question, like, you know, are they really any better than these two drugs? Some of the data that we've seen have not been so amazing that, you know, at least what I've seen in the stuff that's a little bit more advanced in the second generation that says that these drugs are going to be better than the first generation. And if anything, sometimes they seem to be a little bit worse. There's some newer stuff that may possibly overcome, though, the resistance. This RET G810 solvent front mutation. You know, we've seen that with a few of our patients, and it is something that there are some drugs that are supposed to be able to overcome it, at least preclinically. Whether they can overcome it in the clinic, I don't think we know for sure it's going to happen or not. I think Loxo is one of those new agents coming around the corner. I think we're all like, we'll love to see what happens in the selpercatinib or pralsetinib resistant patients.
Is there anything else that you would like to add regarding this topic that we didn't touch on, but you think is important to mention?
I think the one thing we don't have as much data on is what, you know, after, if patients are starting with selpercatinib or pralsetinib, what do you do at progression if you don't have a clinical trial? And, you know, we don't know what the true activity of cabozantinib or vinditinib is after selpercatinib. Or what other drugs may possibly do. I mean, there are some chemotherapy regimens like temozolomide and capecitabine, lenvatinib, which, you know, these are all ones that are probably are more on the compendium approved, but not, have not shown definitely to work. And whether these would work after resistance selpercatinib or pralsetinib, or can you do like a cabozantinib/vinditinib approach? And I think this is like still like a very, very important question that I don't think we really have the real answer to. One of the fortunate things is that, you know, these drugs work so well and they got approved so quickly that we don't really have as much of long-term experience in how to sequence drugs in the future as we might have had with other drugs that have taken a more standard approach. It may take when those, you know, that took a lot more years before they got approved.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Eli Lilly and Company. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.